Hi everyone, welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. In this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined once again by Dr. Yael Ziegler, who is Rosh Beit Midrash and Academic Director of Matan and teaches Tanakh at Herzog College. And we will be discussing her book on Megillas Rus, which is entitled Ruth, From Alienation to Monarchy, and published by Magid, which is an imprint of Koren Publishers. So thank you, Dr. Ziegler, for joining me once again.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's start off. Obviously, we discussed about yourself on our podcast, previous podcast about Eicha. So let's start off about with Rus. Why did you decide? This was your first big book. Eicha was the second one. Why did you decide to write a book on Rus?
Well, so I mean, I had been teaching Megillat Rut for many years, and some of the things that I liked about Rut and that I felt were important enough to write a book about it. Is that, well, first of all, it's the meeting place for many Tanakh ideas, for many Tanakh stories. It enabled me also to have this sort of methodological opportunity to do a lot of intertextual readings to show the meeting place between Rut and Sefer Shoftim, between Rut and Sefer Shmuel, right? Rut, of course, lays the groundwork for melucha, for kingship. And also, of course, many of the connections between Rut and Sefer Bereishit, whether it's Rut and the story of Avram and Lot, or Rut and the story of Yehuda and Tamar. But also, I'll say one other thing, which is that it's a great story. It's sort of seems at first glance like an ordinary story, right? A sweet story, which I think has a lot of compelling messages that can be appreciated by different people, different ages, different, you know, levels of learning, and also ultimately contains messages for how to build a well-functioning society, which I think are some very relevant messages today, you know, especially in the way that Rut kind of contrasts Sefer Shoftim. Sefer Shoftim tells us about how a society disintegrates, and then Megillat Rut gives us the formula for building a society that functions well.
Right, and we'll pick up more on that, the parallel between Shoftim. I think it's something you discuss at length in the beginning of the book, and it's really fascinating. So let's first start with some general, just a general question about the book, and perhaps we discussed this on the previous podcast episode. We did, I don't remember. But are there, what styles and methods that you employ and how you use them when you, throughout this book?
Yeah, so I mean, what I'm doing in the book is essentially what I think the Midrash does, which is to use the methodology of, you know, close readings, noting words, noting syntax, noting parallels between the different stories, different books, different characters, and seeing if I can mine those different discoveries and different things that you see in order to pull out of the book some deeper messages and you know, to understand what is the book trying to accomplish in the broader picture of Tanakh.
Right. And I think, as you note, right, Rus has this concise four-part structure. It's more of a concise, it's like a beginning, middle, end, as opposed to like other Megillas.
Yeah, well, Megillat Rut is also taught actually in universities as the perfect short story, right? I think one of the reasons it's the perfect short story is because of what you said. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And also because it's very well structured, both in terms of the language and the actual structure of the four chapters. So if chapter one, if Perek Aleph sets out the problem in the book, the problem, of course, is the loss of Naomi's family, the loss of the, you know, the future for Naomi's family. By chapter four, we see that everything that has been taken away is basically restored. In chapters two and three, Perek Bet and Perek Gimel show us how that's done in this kind of two-part, very, very neat structure, where Perek Bet shows us the solution for Naomi's economic trials, right? She is in danger of not having any food. And, you know, Perek Gimel shows us the resolution of long-term survival for Naomi's family. And that is, of course, obtaining a child, right? Making sure that we have continuity. And these Perek Bet and Perek Gimel, which are structured very, very similarly, so that they draw attention to the fact that these are two sides of the same coin. Because when you talk about trying to obtain food for immediate survival and trying to obtain children for long-term survival, you're basically talking about Birchat Avraham, the blessing that God gives to Avram, which has been lost by Naomi, right? By Naomi's family. There is not Zera Haaretz, there's not food, and there's not Zera Ha'adam. There's not continuity. So Megillat Rut is this sort of very neat presentation of a problem, a solution, and how we get to that solution. That's kind of the external structure of the book, making it a really readable and a book that kind of makes you feel that all ends have been tied up.
Okay, so what let's discuss Rut. So what is it about? And why, what's the reasons for it being written? I mean, what is it about? I'm sure everyone knows the story, but if you want, you could still say parts of the story, but why was it written? I know you discussed two main reasons for this, but why?
Yeah. So, I think that the very question is worth also discussing, which is, Megillat Rut, unlike Megillat Esther, is not a very dramatic book, right? As you know, the fate of Am Yisrael does not hang in the balance here, right? It seems to be a nice book about nice people doing nice things for each other. And, there's something about it that does lend itself to the question, which Chazal do ask, which is, why was it written, right? And Chazal provide two answers. The more famous answer is, Lilomdecha kama sachar tov legomlei chasadim, to teach us the great reward for those who do kindness. And the perhaps less well-known, but also well-known answer is that it lays the groundwork for the Davidic dynasty. Of course, Megillat Rut takes us to David HaMelech. Now, I would say that the first answer always a little bit troubled me. This idea that we have a whole book to teach us about chesed seemed to me to be a little bit, it seemed a little extraneous. I mean, we can learn chesed from Avram. We can learn chesed from Rivka. We can actually learn chesed from God, right? The idea of God who is, oseh chesed la'alafim. And we have this concept of, imateteo dei, right? Halachta bidrachav. We know that we're supposed to do chesed. Why do we need a whole book to teach us to do chesed? And moreover, I'll say two more things. One is that midrash seems to say not that it teaches us to do chesed, but how great is the reward for one who does chesed, which is rather a strange formulation. And the other thing, I think this is the most perplexing thing about this answer, is that the sort of chesed that I guess especially Rut, but I would include Boaz in this as well, but that Rut is doing in Megillat Rut is a sort of a unique kind of chesed, a chesed of almost self-sacrifice, right? Everything that Rut seems to do in order to do chesed seems to involve sacrificing her own needs, her own interests, starting with the fact that she stays with Naomi, even though Naomi tells her, you have no future with me, no one will marry you, there's no one back in Beit Lechem who, can give you a child, you might as well go home to Moab if you want to have a family. And ending with the fact that Rut essentially at the end of the book relinquishes her child to Naomi and then kind of falls out of the story. So the question that I had when I read that midrash was, what is the midrash really saying when it says that the purpose of Megillat Rut is to teach us the great reward of chesed? And here's where I think that there is a connecting line between these two midrashim, because it seems to me that really what Chazal are saying about Megillat Rut is that Megillat Rut is teaching us the type of chesed that needs to be done in order to build a functional infrastructure of leadership. Leadership, of course, especially kingship, is something that the Tanakh is very conflicted about, right? Remember when in Shmuel, when the people come to Shmuel and ask for a king, and Shmuel becomes enraged and God becomes enraged and says, no, Shmuel, it's not you they're rejecting, it's me they're rejecting. And there seems to be a real tension that revolves around the question of milucha, of kingship. And I think that one of the things that the Tanakh is responding to is the fact that kingship has been and always will be dangerous, right? power is dangerous. Leadership is dangerous. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And therefore, I think what Miguelat Root is trying to sort of guide us towards is a certain type of chesed that maybe not the usual sort of chesed that we are all required to do, but chesed that is absolutely essential for our leaders. And it's the kind of chesed which, like the chesed that Root does, is self-nullifying, right? We have this like sort of remarkable phenomenon in Perek Gimel, which my brother once pointed out to me, my brother, Dr. Mordechai Zeiger, who lives in Baltimore. So he once pointed out to me that if you look in Root Perek Gimel, you have a Masoretic phenomenon. There's the Balei Mesorah put a Kriv Eloch Tiv twice in Perek Gimel. And the Kriv Eloch Tiv is the word Eli, right? It appears outside of, in your Tanakhs, it appears outside of the Pasuk. And of course, if you're reading from the cloth, from the Megillah, you just have a blank there. And what my brother suggested is that in both of these instances, Ruth is speaking about herself, but she takes the Eli out of the sentence. And that really gives you a sense of who Ruth is. Who is Ruth? Ruth is the one who can say, it's not about me. If you give me food, I give it to Naomi. If you give me a child, I give it to Naomi. And imagine if the king had that kind of attitude. He has all the power concentrated in his hands. If you give him the power over the judiciary, the power over the treasury, the power over the military, but he doesn't see it as being for himself, but rather he sees himself as some kind of empty vessel that is giving it over to the people, you have yourself a wonderful formula for kingship that will not become an exercise in tyranny, in corruption, in debauchery. I just want to make one more point. I know I've been talking for a long time, but the other point that that my brother pointed out, which I think was really a wonderful idea, which I put in my book and I actually gave him credit for it, which is that you know when the Midrash is doing etymologies of the different names in Ruth. So the Midrash wreaks havoc with Elimelech's etymology, right? And, you know, Elimelech, why did Elimelech, Naomi's husband, why was he named Elimelech? Clearly because his mother wanted to say, my God is king, Elimelech. But what does the Midrash say? The Midrash says, Elimelech used to walk around saying, Eli Tavo Hamalchut, to me shall come the kingship. And what is really extraordinary here, which my brother pointed out, is that what is Midrash saying? Ruth deserves kingship because she knows how to take the Eli out of her sentences. And Elimelech is unqualified for kingship because he walks around saying, the kingship is for me, Eli, right? Which I think is really a nice indication of how once you kind of dig deeply into the Midrashim, you really see, you know, what they're really trying to say.
Right. Now, picking up a little bit more, a little bit deeper on what you were saying. So, I mean, so you discuss this in the book that the roots of Rus really are this chesed is Loit and Avram, which is really what's going on over here with Rus and then eventually with Boaz.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it seems pretty clear that Root is being regarded here as an Avram-like figure, right? You know, when Boaz meets her in the field and he's nice to her and she falls on her face in amazement and says, Madua matzatichin beinecha la kireni, v'anochi nochriya, right? Why have I found favor in your eyes? I'm a stranger. And he says to her, he makes this wonderful speech. He says, Huged hugadli kol asher asit, et chamotech, it has surely been told to me everything that you did with your mother-in-law, Chrei Moti Sheikh, after your husband died. Vata'azvi avich ve'imech ve'eretz moladtech, v'telchi el am asher lo yadat t'mol shel shom, right? You left your father, your mother, your birthplace, and I see you smiling because you, as I'm sure many of the listeners, are hearing echoes of God's first words to Avram, lech lecha meretzcha u'mimoladcha u'mibeit avicha el ha'aretz asher areka, right? Go out from your father's house. So we have this I think really what Boaz's statement to Ruth is meant to be is you are Avram-like. You are Avram-like because you're a giver of food. You are Avram-like because you're a giver of loyalty. You're Avram-like because you assume responsibility for the other. And therefore, Ruth becomes the one who can kind of guide Am Yisrael back to the path of Avram during a very difficult period of the Shoftim, a period in which they basically, they seem to have strayed from Avram's path, the path of Chesed. And instead, where do we wind up at the end of Sefer Shoftim? We wind up in a Sodom and Amorah story. We wind up with the story of the concubine in Giv'ah, where, you know, finally she and her husband are taken into the house of one kind man who's not a local, right? And then the people get wind of it. The people of Giv'ah get wind of the fact that somebody hosted these guests, and they surround the house and they demand to rape the guests. And it's this Sodom and Amorah-like story, which really, I think, you know, it should strike us as both being horrific because it means that Am Yisrael has become Kistom Hayinu La'amora Daminu, in the words of Yeshayahu, right? We're like Sodom and Amorah, which suggests that we no longer have the right to exist. But at the same time, also it suggests that in leaving Avram's path, Am Yisrael finds itself in Lot's path. Right? They kind of find themselves in a place which is the antithesis of Avram. You know, there's I think, another kind of wonderful linguistic moment that makes this point, that really drives this point home, which is that when Lot leaves Avram, you know, when Avram tells him to leave, right? Avram says to him, "He pare na me'alai," right? Im hayamin va'asma'ila v'imasmol ve'emina, right? You know, separate yourself from me. You go left, I'll go right. You go right, I'll go left, right? And of course, that's because their shepherds have been fighting, and we're told Lot doesn't go either right or left, as the Sforno points out. He doesn't listen to Avram. Instead, he goes straight ahead to Sodom and Amorah, which is a place where Anshei Sodom ra'im v'chata'im la'Hashem me'od, they are very evil. And he goes there, and of course he encounters a city which is the antithesis of Avram. And, you know, we kind of find Am Yisrael straying in that direction during the period of the Shoftim. And Ruth, who is a Moabite, who is from the descendants of Lot, she makes her way back to Avram's path. And in fact, when she says to Naomi, "I'm not leaving you," and she takes that great oath of loyalty to Naomi, "El asher telchi eilech, uvasher talini alin, amech ami ve'elokayich elokai," right? Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lie, I will lie. Your people is my people. Your God is my God. She ends it with an oath. And the oath is, "Ko yaseh Hashem li v'cho yosif, ki hamavet yafrid beinu veinech." Only death will separate us. And it's the same word that is used to describe Lot separating from Avraham. He pare na me'alai, right? Vayipardu ish me'al achiv. They separated. So we have this kind of much broader story in which Ruth is, it kind of becomes the closure for the story, which begins with Lot leaving Avraham and, you know, producing Moab on the backdrop of this very bad choice. And Ruth makes the opposite choice and comes back to the Avram path.
Now, I want to emphasize what you just said there. Part of what you said, you talked about the parallel to Shoftim. Maybe emphasize that a little bit more. Why is Rus not part of Shoftim? It really is part of Shoftim, but they're talking about Shoftim. That's what's going on. So this is something that you emphasize very strongly in the book, and you kind of mentioned a bunch of it, but why is it not in Shoftim?
Yeah, so that's a really important question. That question, of course, becomes strengthened by our tradition, our Mesorah in Bava Batra, which is that Shmuel wrote both of these books, right? So even more so, you want to ask yourself, if Shmuel wrote both these books, so why didn't he put root into Sefer Shoftim. It does take place, as you said, at the same time period. But I think that the minute that that we understand the goal of these books, you understand why it's not in Sefer Shoftim. And I think you can really kind of simplify this idea with one very important observation, which is that the Megillat Rut, Sefer Shoftim is the story of a society that disintegrates and really kind of spirals into a situation of religious and social disintegration. And the final pasuk of Sefer Shoftim is Bayamim Haheim Ein Melech B'Yisrael Ish Hayashar Beinav Yaseh. In those days, there's no king of Israel, and therefore everyone does whatever they want to do. And of course, that's chaos, right? Tohu vavohu. They're behaving terribly in terms of their social behavior, in terms of their religious behavior. There's idolatry, pesel micha. There's this, you know, there's this terrible story of the rape of the concubine in Giv'ah, and then there's civil war. But look at how Megillat Rut ends. What are the last words of Megillat Rut? V'yishai holid et David. In other words, Yesh Melech B'Yisrael. There is a king in Israel. So all of Megillat Rut is leading us away from the unraveling of Sefer Shoftim. And I think really, the simplest kind of like idea of this book is, what is the purpose of Megillat Rut? The purpose of Megillat Rut is to teach us how to emerge from the terrible mire in which we find ourselves at the end of Sefer Shoftim. You know, I'll just mention, an example, which I think is a really powerful example, which is that Sefer Shoftim, kind of moves us to, throughout Sefer Shoftim, there's no chesed, right? The word chesed appears only twice in all of the book, once in the negative, lo asu chesed, and once in a military context. And Megillat Rut is filled with chesed. Sefer Shoftim is a book in which people are not giving food to each other. Think of the story of Gideon asking the people of Sukkot and Penuel to give food to his troops. And, and he's met with a very kind of almost cynical refusal. Sefer Shoftim, and here's I think, a really kind of interesting omission. Sefer Shoftim never has the word ge'ula, never has the word ga'al, right? Now, okay, I don't know why we would necessarily expect it in Sefer Shoftim, but I want to say something about the word ge'ula, which is that the word ge'ula in the Torah almost always is used in the context of not what God does for Am Yisrael, like we're accustomed, in our colloquial usage of Geula, or in the prophetic usage of Geula, but in the Torah, and especially in Parshat Behar, in Vayikra Kafhei, the word Ga'al is used in the context of taking social responsibility for the other. There is no Geula in Sefer Shoftim. Well, you know what we have in Rut? We have a book of chesed. The word chesed appears over and over, and people are giving food. Certainly Boaz gives Ruth food and Ruth gives Naomi food. And the word ga'al, you know how many times appears in Megillat Rut? 23 times in 4 chapters. And it's all about human beings, or really primarily Boaz, taking responsibility for their, for their relatives, for their family, for each other. And so, it winds up that Megillat Rut teaches us how the assumption of social responsibility is the way to, build a community, to build a well-functioning society. Whereas the minute that we begin to lose our sense of loyalty, of kindness, of compassion, of social responsibility, things begin to spiral out of control. And, I'll make one final point with regard to this, because this is a critical point, which is that Sefer Shoftim, this is the point actually that relates to the title of my book, From Alienation to Monarchy, which is that Sefer Shoftim ends with these 5 chapters of anonymous figures, people who are unnamed, right? That we have this concubine and her husband and her father and the nice man from Ephraim who takes them in. And then we have, the people of Binyamin and the Ziknei Ha'edah, the elders. Nobody gets a name. right? And what is a society in which nobody gets a name? I mean, you know, it's only a few weeks ago that we commemorated Yom HaShoah. We know what it means to take away people's names and substitute it for numbers. It means that we have people who don't see each other as human beings. They see each other as objects. And that's why they can do these terrible things that they do at the end of Sefer Shoftim. And that's why they can refuse to give food to each other and refuse to be kind to each other, because they don't actually see each other as human beings. While Megillat Rut is ostensibly about restoring names, the whole goal of Megillat Rut is lahakim shem hamet al nachalato, to give back names. And Megillat Rut ends with names, right? Ela toldot paretz, paretz holid chetzron, chetzron holid ram, etc., etc., right? So we have these really opposite movements. Sefer Shoftim takes us to a period of alienation, and Megillat Rut takes us to a period of monarchy. And all of that is built on these rather unremarkable social interactions, which become remarkable only when we see how critical they are for building a well-functioning society.
Now, we do the, it start, like you said, it talk process with names, and we start off with names. However, the we'll talk about the cast of characters, but when it starts off with the names, three of those names are still Shoftim-like. When you have, to some extent, you can discuss them. At least we'll start off with them, with Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilian.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're picking up, I think, on a really important point that, you know, I didn't say before, but is absolutely true, which is that all of the background characters of Sefer of Megillat Rut are Shoftim-like characters, which makes the actions of Rut and Boaz all the more remarkable. They're not acting that way because they live in this little bubble of the period of the Shoftim. They're acting that way because they are really remarkable individuals who act against the general kind of trajectory of society. Again, you know, when I think of Megillat Rut, and I've had, thank God, the zchut, the opportunity to teach Megillat Rut to all sorts of ages and you know, and kihilot. And one of the things that I find is that you can teach Megillat Rut to really young people. And the messages are really so clear and simple. And one of the messages is the power of the individual to change society, right? So we have, you know, because really you're absolutely right. Elimelech, Mahlon, Chilion, they're part of the problem of Sefer Shoftim. That's why they have these names. They're part of what is really going to be cut off, or what you know, and even just look at their first act. What's their first act? They go to Moab during a famine. Now, Chazal, the Midrashim, I think many people are aware, are excessively harsh with them, right? Chazal, really, they say terrible things about them. They say, oh, yes, you know, they had lots of food in their house and the people came, or they had lots of money and the people came and surrounded their house. Zebekupato, vezebekupato, right? Each one with their tzedakah box. And when they look out of the window and see all those needy people, they put all of their property on their donkeys and they go hightailing it off for Moab. Well, you know, where do Chazal get that? And by the way, note that it's an inverted Pilegish Begivah story, right? With the bad people inside and the good people outside in this case. But that, you know, what's really interesting to me, I thought a lot about these Midrashim, because what's really interesting to me is, you know, why are they so harsh, the Midrashim, with Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilion? Where do they get this idea that that the family had food that they were hiding? And I think that the answer lies in their destination. Where do they go? Where do people usually go during a drought, during a famine? They go to Egypt. Now, this family goes to Moab, and we know that Moab is not exactly known for being generous with their food, right? Why are we not allowed to marry Moabites, according to Devarim Perek Kaf Gimel? Al devar asher lo kidmu etchem belechem uvamayim bederech betzeitchem mimitzrayim, because they didn't give us food and water. So one of the things that Chazal are saying, I think, is if this family is going to Moab during a famine, they have food. They're not depending on Moab to give them food. And perhaps even more significantly, they're going to Moab because they identify with Moab. They're Moab-like. And what is Moav like? Sodom and Gomorrah like. So these Judean leaders, these, you know, people from Yehuda are basically Shoftim people. Shoftim winds up in Sodom and Gomorrah. And where do the Judean leaders go? To Moav, who are the spiritual heirs of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? So they really are what you're saying, you know, about their this sort of Shoftim-like cast of characters who have these, certainly Machlon and Chilion seem to have these problematic names, which, you know, seem to allude to their end. Their, you know, they seem to be a mirror of Am Yisrael during the period of the Shoftim. And I would say the same is true about many of the minor characters that we find in the book. You know, you look at the women of Beit Lechem, when Naomi comes back and they see her, they say, Hazot Naomi. And then they don't give her anything. They don't give her food. They don't even ask about Ruth. They're completely uninterested in who is with her. You know, think of Ploni Almoni, who doesn't have a name. Why doesn't he have a name, right? He doesn't have a name because he refuses to assume social responsibility. He's part of the problem, the alienated society, the society with no names, right? And this is really, I think, you know, the general cast of characters in that route are very Shoftim-like characters, including, by the way, the reapers in the field every year on Shavuot, assuming I'm awake when they're reading Sefer Rut, which I try to be, but every single year when we read Boaz's words to Rut, when he's speaking to her in the field, and he says to her, Halo tziviti et ha-ne'arim levilti nog'ech, I commanded the reapers, the boys, not to touch you. I get goosebumps. I said, what do you mean? You have to command the reapers in the field of Beit Lechem not to abuse Ruth, not to harass her? It's indicative of a society which has spiraled out of control. It's not a morally functioning society. It's not a society that's functioning in the way that Am Yisrael is supposed to function. So Ruth and Boaz are the exception in Megillat Ruth, and they really turn around the trajectory of society.
Now we get to one of the big characters in the book, and one of the enigmatic in some ways is Naomi. Is Naomi? I mean, and you have a half a page here when you start off Naomi in the book, and you wrote, "Who is Naomi? Is she an active party to the decision to abandon Beis Lechem during the famine, or is she an adjunct of her husband? How should we understand Naomi's eventual decision to return to Beis Lechem? Is she hopeless and suicidal, returning to Beis Lechem in order to die, or is she cautiously optimistic, returning to Beis Lechem to reconstruct her life?" And then you go on: Is Naomi an empathetic mother-in-law? Is she an emblem of piety or bitterly angry at Hashem? I mean, all these questions really come up with her in the book. I mean, so I'll let you discuss. I mean, who is she?
Yeah, it's a really hard one. And your word enigmatic, I think, is really the right word. By the way, you know, we may emphasize certain Midrashim more than others, but I will say that the Midrashim are conflicted about Naomi. You know, the jury is out on Naomi in the text, but also in the Midrashic readings of Naomi. You know, when I worked on this, I found Naomi to be the most enigmatic figure. What I proposed in my book is that Naomi is a reflection of the people during the period of the Shoftim. And that, you know, ultimately she's the main character in the book, right? In a sense, because Megillat Rut is about Am Yisrael. It's not about this one family. It's about how, by turning around the trajectory of Naomi's life, we also can turn around the trajectory of Am Yisrael's life. So Naomi kind of gets pulled to Moav, just like Am Yisrael kind of, you know, go with the flow to Sodom and Gomorrah. And, you know, by the end of the story, Naomi has hope. Naomi has a goel. Naomi has her name back, right? Remember, she says, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara," right? And you know, she seems to have lost hope. She is clearly, I would say, even blaming God, right? Yatzavi Yad Hashem, the hand of God. Is she feels that God has caused her to become bitter. She says that several times. Well, by the end of the book, you know, the women are blessing her in the name of God, and she, you know, she she has been restored, right? She comes back to life again. And I think that the goal is to do the same thing for Am Yisrael, that this child who will eventually set up the kingship and will be responsible for setting up a society that works is going to bring names back to not just Naomi's family, but back to the people. So that was what I proposed. But I agree with you that Naomi is the most complex figure in the book.
Now, I don't know, in some ways it's surprising. I think we've made it this far in and we haven't mentioned one of the other figures. I don't think we've mentioned Orpah yet.
Orpah, right? Who, by the way, is definitely a secondary figure. So, you know, we haven't really mentioned Boaz yet either. And I think that he's really important. But I will say something about Orpah, which is that, I don't know, I always thought, again, you know, I looked at some of the Midrashim and I felt that the Midrashim were very harsh with Orpah. Right? If you look at the Midrashim, they are really excessively harsh with her. And some of the Midrashim, which describe her not just as cruel, but as very promiscuous, right? There's a whole series of Midrashim that describe her promiscuity. And actually, when you read through the text itself, you get the feeling that she kind of does what you would expect people to do, right? Certainly when you compare her to Ruth and she becomes a kind of a literary foil for Ruth. Well, yeah, I mean, she comes out wanting, but if you look at her in her own right, you know, Naomi says to her, don't come with me. You have no future with me. You have no possibility of having a family or having children. So, you know, go back to Moab. And she cries and she says, no, I want to be with you. I want to stay with you. And she seems utterly sincere and no different than Ruth. And then, of course, in the moment of truth, she does choose to go back and start her own family, which, I don't know, I mean, on some level, seems like a very reasonable and even moral decision. The way that I look at Orpah, certainly in the eyes of Chazal, is as, I think Chazal are telling us something about Orpah's choice more than about Orpah the person. What I think Chazal are saying is, if you make the Lot choice and you go live in Moab, you're going to wind up being Sodom and Gomorrah. You're going to wind up cruel and promiscuous because that society is cruel and promiscuous. If you look at Chazal's depiction of Ruth, it is the diametrical opposite of Orpah. Ruth is the emblem of kindness and also of what Chazal always say about Ruth. She is the tsanua, right? She is the modest one. And I think, again, I think Chazal are commenting not necessarily on something that Ruth is doing in the story, certainly in terms of her modesty, but more on the choice that she makes to leave Moab behind and come to to walk on the path of Avraham. I think that is Chazal's point, rather than, you know, to see these Midrashim as maligning Orpah personally, which is not really indicated in the story itself.
Okay, and I know you mentioned we have to talk about Boaz, but before we get to him, we really should talk a little bit more about Rus. I know in the book you mentioned Rus. I think the title of the chapter is Love and Devotion, how her devotion to Naomi and her love for Hashem, for God. So talk a little bit more about Rus specifically.
Yeah. You know, it's hard not to talk about Ruth because she is, first of all, she's the eponymous heroine, right? The story is named after her. And so we're immediately drawn to her. And, you know, we did a little bit talk about her before as this embodiment of Avram-like values. We also spoke about the fact that she is an emblem of a certain kind of chesed, right? A chesed, which is one that we very much expect from our leaders. And so she becomes the mother of kingship. One thing that we didn't talk very much about is, her loyalty to God, her Ahavat Hashem, which is not so pronounced, but is latently present. There's one of the questions that I think we do ask is, why did she stay with Naomi? So certainly the loyalty, her fidelity to Naomi is unquestionable, right? But at the same time, Chazal tend to learn from Rut what is real dveikut, right? Or dveikus, right? It was, you know, this idea that that particular word, you know, Rut davkaba, Rut cleaves to Naomi. And that word is usually used or often used about what we are meant to do towards God, right? So you can sort of extrapolate from Ruth's behavior, the way, the kind of unwavering loyalty and devotion that we're meant to have to God, even when it's illogical, even when it doesn't seem to be something that's in our immediate best interest. You know, the two places I would say, though, where we do see Ruth's love for Naomi and love for God as being somewhat equated is, first of all, in her oath, right, where she says, Amech ami ve'elokayich elokai, right? She, of course, specifically notes that she wants to remain not just with Naomi, but part of Naomi's nation and part of Naomi's service of God. And Boaz seems to recognize this, because Boaz, when he pronounces her great, her great milus, right? You know, all of her great attributes. So he says, you know, we started mentioning it before, Hugedu Gadli Kol Asher Asit Et Chamotech, right? Everything that you did. And then he says to her, Yeshalem Hashem Poalech, God should repay you for your deeds. Utihi maskortech shleima me'im Hashem Elokei Israel asher bat lachasot tachat knafav. Right? Your reward should be full from God, who you came in order to dwell under God's wings. It's a beautiful formulation, and it indicates that even Boaz understands that Ruth's loyalty to Naomi is also somehow interwoven in her love for God, in her desire to be part of serving God as part of Am Yisrael.
So now we get to Boaz, and we did mention Boaz before a little bit when he you know, and this is something more we'll emphasize, his kindness especially.
Yeah. So, you know, I'll say something about Boaz, because really I think Boaz is kind of the I would say the prime mover in the story, but as we all know, and the Rambam says, God is the prime mover. So, and in the story, God is the prime mover, actually. You know, the God only appears actively twice in the story. Right. All the time people are mentioning God. It's a very it's a book that's filled with mentions of God. But God himself only appears twice in the story. One is in the very beginning to give the people food. And the second is at the very end to give a child. And again, it's Birchat Avram. It's Zera Haaretz and Zera Haadam. God is the one who gives food. God is, you know, remember we talk about the three keys, right? At the in Masechet Ta'anit, right? God has three keys, the keys of rain, the keys of childbirth. So God gives both food and children, but then Boaz becomes the recipient who then can give over God's blessing, right? So Boaz is really the one who kind of sets into motion the solution in the story. Boaz gives these things to Ruth. He gives Ruth food. He gives Ruth a child. And Ruth gives it to Naomi, right? But I think that the real question when we get to Boaz is why is he so different, right? There's, you know, everybody around him is behaving in really abominable ways. I mean, really terrible behavior, both in Sefer Shoftim and in Megillat Rut. They're not behaving properly in terms of their moral conduct. They're not behaving properly in terms of their treatment of the other. And here's Boaz, who is, you know, just really kind of plodding along, doing the right thing while everybody around him is not, and extraordinary acts of kindness. So what enables Boaz to be all these things and to do all these things? So I think that the idea of Boaz is that, Boaz retains his name, right? He is introduced with the words, Ushmo Boaz, right? His name is Boaz. And I think that the reason that Boaz retains his name is because he sees the other, right? When he first arrives in the field and he sees Ruth, right? He says, Lemi hanara hazot, who is that girl? And, you know, there's a Gemara in Shabbos, and Daf Kuf Yud Gimel, where the Gemara asks the question, you know, v'chi darko shel Boaz lish'ol achar hanashim? Is that Boaz's way? He comes into the field and he asks about the girls. What kind of question is that, right? So the Gemara says, well, devar chokhmah ra'aba, devar tzniut ra'aba. He saw that she was very wise and very knowledgeable about halacha. He saw that she was very modest. But I would kind of reframe the question. To me, the question is not why Boaz asks about her. It's why nobody else does. You see, Boaz's question is really the continuation of the women's question previously, right? Previously, the women said, Hazot Naomi. And what didn't they say? Ulamihanara Hazot, who is this girl? Now Boaz comes in, and the first thing he sees is this young woman who is picking like a pauper in the fields, and he wants to understand what has reduced her to this kind of desperate situation. And he turns to her, and right away he begins to speak to her. And she says to him, Madua matzati chein be'enecha lehakireni. What is she most appreciative of? She's most appreciative that he has recognized her. And to understand how unusual this is, we have to understand that that word lahakir appears three times in Megillat Rut. Once is when Rut says, I can't believe it. Like, why have you recognized me? And the other is when she comes back with an armful of grain and Naomi says to her, Eifo likatatayom ve'ana asit yehi makirech. Baruch, let the one who recognized you be blessed. Then all of this is because in Perek Gimel, we learn that this is a period, I'm kind of paraphrasing it, I'm doing kind of a midrashic reading, but Biterem Yakir Ish et Re'ehu. Sefer Shoftim is a period in which people are no longer recognizing each other. They're not seeing each other as people. They're not seeing, with their own eyes that there's a person standing in front of them, not an object. And you know, therefore, I think one of the most remarkable moments in the book, and again, you know, there are these sort of extraordinary lessons in these ordinary moments, is when Rut has come down to Boaz on the threshing floor in the middle of the night in this very, very difficult scenario, which I know, you know, everybody's sort of perplexed by this scenario of Perek Gimel. And, you know, it seems to be a very kind of, you know, laden, weighty scenario, which is very suggestive. And, you know, then we have this pasuk, which tells us, you know, vayhi b'chatzi halayla, it was at the midpoint of the night, vayecherad ha'ish margalotav, right? He wakes up in the middle of the night and he sees a woman lying next to his feet. And what's interesting about that pasuk is that it's not Rut and Boaz. It's an ish and an isha. It's a man and a woman, no names, right? And you know, the moment seems ripe for things to go in a certain direction. And Chazal are very aware of this, right? Chazal tell us, Kol oto halayla, haya yitzro shel Boaz mekatrigo ve'omer, ata panoi umevakesh isha, vihi pruya umevakeshet ish amod uvoala v'saveal yitzrecha, right? He says that whole night, Boaz's kind of ardor was, you know, hammering away at him saying, you're single and you're looking for a woman, she's single, she's looking for a man, you know, maybe just sleep with her. And that's where the scenario seems to be going. But the turning point of the book is when Boaz wakes up, he sees a woman lying by his feet. And you know what he does? He says two words, Vayomer mi'at. Who are you? Right? He turns her from object to subject. And that's not just the turning point of Megillat Rut. That's the turning point for Sefer Shoftim. When you can look at somebody and see beyond their objectness, what they can do for you, right? But you see them as human beings. That's when you treat them properly. That's when society begins to come together as a healthy, well-functioning, moral society.
So that's basically the third parak. You ready? That's what I was going to ask you. So you got it, which is good. But then we get to the last one. Now we get this kind of interesting with plenty almoni with no name. We get the chalitza and the yibam. What's going on with that?
Yeah, that's it. It's, you know, look, plenty almoni is, as we said before, he's part of the problem. That's why he doesn't get a name, because he doesn't assume social responsibility. But I think you really are asking here about, you know, what is the Yibum story here, right? That's what you're asking. You know, you're saying Daf Yomi is doing Yivamos now, right? So that's, I guess, on everybody's mind. And what's interesting about Megillat Rut is that Megillat Rut is filled with Yibum-like words and phrases, right? I mean, the actual word Yibum, it really only appears in three places in Tanakh. One is in the story of Yehuda and Tamar. The other one is in the mitzvah of Yibum in Devarim Kafe. And the third is in Rut Perek Aleph, when Orpah is referred to twice as Yivim Teich, which really means the other woman who could get Yibum, right? You know, and lots of other phrases, like the phrase Eshet Hamet only appears in these, in Megillat Rut and in a Yibum-like context. The words Im lo yachpots, right? When Boaz says to Rut on the threshing floor, Lini halayla v'hayava boker im yigalech tov yigal v'im lo yachpots l'galech, if he does not desire to redeem you. And those same words appear with Chalitza. Of course, we have somehow in Perek Dalid the role of the shoe, right? The na'al. And, you know, lots of other, phrases like lahakim shem hamet, right? Velo yikaret shem hamet, so that we shouldn't, you know, erase the name of the dead person. Vikaresh shmo b'Yisrael, right? There are all these phrases that hark back to Devarim Perek Kafhei, which is the only place where we have the mitzvah of Yibum. So it makes us kind of feel like there's a Yibum story going on here. But, you know, our Mefarshim and Midrashim, almost without exception, I say almost without exception because there's one maybe, Targum that seems to go a bit in a different direction. But in general, our Midrashim and Mefarshim are very clear that this is not Yibum. Now, Ibn Ezra is extremely insistent on this point because, as he says, this was a point of contention between the Karaites and Jewish tradition and our Jewish tradition, where, you know, we know that one of the problems with Yibum is that Yibum holds two contradictory, principles. One is that you can never marry your brother's wife. And the other is, well, in case where the brother, you know, dies without children, then you must marry your brother's wife. So those are two kind of contradictions. So we believe that Yibum overrides the usual arayot of the brother's wife. The Karaites believe the arayot overrides Yibum, and therefore Yibum is only done with relatives, but not with the actual brother. So this is a point of, and their proof, of course, is Megillat Rut. So this is a point of great sensitivity for the Ibn Ezra, who is contending with this kind of, you know, Karaite approach. And what he says, and what I think is largely accepted, the Ramban says it as well in his commentary on Yehuda and Tamar in Bereishit Perek Lamed Chet, is that this isn't Yibum, but it's a Yibum-like mitzvah. It's called Ge'ula, that's what the Ramban says, and it's designed to bring about Yibum-like results, which is to ensure that the name of the dead person doesn't get erased and that there's some kind of posterity. And also, I would add, I mean, you know, that we've also taken care of, certainly this is evident in Megillat Rut, of this kind of vulnerable wife who doesn't have necessarily the economic means of survival. And so, you know, this idea of someone in the family taking responsibility by marrying the wife of someone who is deceased without children is, I think, a very worthy principle. And, you know, that in that way, I think we resolve the Yibum-like piece of life. And look, you know, throughout Megillat Rut, there's no indication that this is actually Yibum. I mean, it's not the brother, but aside from it not being the brother, there's no spitting. There's no, there's no, even though they do go up to the gate and there are the elders there, it's not even clear that Rut is present. And the other thing is that it's clear that Rut can choose whether or not she has to marry the relative, which is not the case with Yibum. You'd have to do chalitza if you don't desire that. But, you know, Boaz says very explicitly, you know, he taft chastecha acharon min arishon livilti lechet acharei habachurim im dal ve'im asher, right? You did a great chesed that you didn't go after the younger men. And, you know, even the fact that Naomi doesn't come straight to Boaz and say, well, you know, you got to find someone to marry Ruth because someone, you know, has to do Yibum, indicates that this is not Yibum. So that's kind of the summary of the Yibum situation.
Okay. Then after that, we get the end of the Megillah comes quickly, where Boaz you know, it's a quick happy ending, like we said. Baez marries her, she gets pregnant, she has a son, and then Nami gets back involved, and then we read off the genealogy until David HaMelech.
Yeah. I mean, really, the end of the book is, as we said before, it's the restoration of names. You know, that's why I said from alienation to monarchy, right? It's not just, you know, Perek Dalet, we talked a little bit about the importance of words. Some of the Midrashim are even sensitive to keywords, words that appear over and over. And this is definitely something that, today in academic circles, keywords are, you know, considered to be a clue as to, you know, what the story is about. And in Perek Dalet, the word shame appears seven times. Keywords often appear in multiples of seven, right? Like you see in Bereishi Perek Aleph, right? So, you know, the word shame appears seven times in Perek Dalet. When Boaz is, marrying Ruth, he actually makes this proclamation where he mentions everybody's name. He says, "Kaniti et kol asher le'eli melech, et kol asher le'chilyon u'machlon miyad Naomi," right? In one pasuk, he mentions everybody's name. And then by the time we get to the end of the book, as I mentioned before, we, you know, kind of restore names backwards and forwards, right? So that it becomes, once again, a society which is built on seeing each other's names. And that's the sort of society where, you know, where people function. You know, look, I would also say there's a lot of reversals. I mentioned at the very beginning of our discussion that, you know, Perek Aleph is really resolved by Perek Dalet. So, you know, you see it in so many ways. You know, in Perek Aleph, Naomi says, you know, "Gam hayiti alayla leish v'gam yaladti banim." She says, like, even if I would be with a man tonight and I would have children. She says it in this almost, you know, a caustic way, right? It's clear to her that she would never have children. But by the end, what do the women say? "Yulad ben l'Naomi," right? Naomi had a child, even though, you know, not literally, but certainly figuratively. And, you know, those same women at the beginning of the story in Perek Aleph, who, you know, kind of like, you know, greeted Naomi, but were absolutely not helpful to Naomi in any way, so that three psukim later, after their greeting, we find Naomi alone and starving, and, you know, needs to really go and procure her own food. Well, by the end, we have these women who have come back to give blessings to Naomi, you know, "B'shem Hashem, Baruch Hashem, Asher lo ishbit lach goel hayom." And Naomi had said, "Don't, you know, I don't have a name." And now they say, "V'karei Shemo b'Yisrael," right? So there's a real reversal in Perek Dalet of all of the things that seem to have been lost in Perek Aleph. And, you know, what I think is that this all has bearing on Sefer Shoftim, that Perek Dalet is the turnaround that is moving the trajectory of Sefer Shoftim from a place of dysfunction back to the place where Am Yisrael, you know, wants to be in fulfilling their goals, our goals as a nation.
Okay. Obviously, there's a lot more than to Rus and to your book than we discussed. The book is over 500 pages. So, and I'll put a link in the show's notes that people can purchase it. It's a lot more than we discussed, but just two final questions. First of all, we've discussed a lot of different sources, but like, what specific sources did you use in this book?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm very interested in, I mean, I come from, let's say, two worlds, right? I'm academically trained in terms of, you know, that I got my doctorate at Bar-Ilan, and I remain today, and, you know, I hope I'll always remain in the world of the Beit Midrash, right? So that for me, the you know, both, I think, Parshanut, but especially Midrash, it is a world that really, I think, deepens and enhances my understanding of Megillat Rut. And one of the things that I was trying to do, and I actually wrote a methodological introduction to the book because I wanted it to be clear what I was trying to do. One of the things that I try to do is take the rigor and the methodology that I learned in university and combine it with the inspiration and the depth of meaning that I've always found in the Midrash, and to emerge with this book. So, you know, that's what I tried to do. That's what I hope that I was able to accomplish. But really, you know, what I'm looking for are the deeper messages of Megillat Rut that are both inspirational, meaningful, and that clarify Megillat Rut's place within the broader story of Tanakh and the broader goals of Tanakh, the broader themes of Tanakh. And ultimately, of course, I mentioned this at the beginning, but it's worth mentioning also towards the end, which is, you know, that we have this opportunity today in, you know, the last 100 years to really think about what kind of society we are building as an autonomous society in the land of Israel for the first time in, you know, 2000 years. And some of these messages, which again, they seem so mundane and maybe even so almost trivial, but they're messages, I think, that really have the power to make society better. You know, sometimes when I talk to really young kids about Megillat Rut, I say, well, the goal of Megillat Rut, like Boaz, is to see the name of the other person, which sometimes just means saying hello to a person by name, right? You pass someone in the street, you say hello to them by name, you meet someone, you try to remember their name. You know, there's a remarkable midrash, which I think really sums up this idea. The midrash tells us, Shlosha dvarim gazru beitin shel mata, the beitin shel mala kiblu, right? The three things were decreed by an earthly court that were accepted by a heavenly court. And one of those three things was instituted by Boaz. And that was she'ilat shem b'shem Hashem, that you can ask after the welfare of your friend using the name of God. Remember when Boaz approaches the Kotzrim, he says, Hashem imachem, and they respond, Yivarecha Hashem. We're very careful about pronouncing Shem Hashem. And so what this midrash seems to be suggesting is that what is it that Boaz teaches us more than anything else? He teaches us that asking after your friend's welfare, that inquiring after your fellow person is so important to God that he's almost mochel al kvodo, right? He's mochel al shmo. He allows you to use Shem Hashem in asking after your friend's welfare, which I think is a remarkably simple but critical message, one that can be understood by all ages, in all contexts, but which really lies at the heart of creating a wonderful society.
And the last thing I'll ask you is, I mean, obviously it's your book and you recommend it to everybody, but would you recommend someone to pick this up to read it? Is it looking for a more in-depth analysis and reading of Rus? I mean, what would you recommend? What do you recommend?
Well, first of all, as I said, I think Megillat Rut, the book, can appeal to many ages. One of the things that I tried to do was you know, to keep my academic sources in footnotes. You know, I don't know if you noticed when you saw the book, but I really don't put any academic sources in the body of the book. For those people who want to further their understanding, it's there, it's in the footnotes. But really, in the book itself, it's mostly, you know, parshanim, midrashim, and, you know, close readings of the story itself. I also tried to divide the book into shorter chapters so that each chapter could be read in its own right. You know, you can open the book and look at a chapter that speaks to you. I mean, I assume many people are already familiar with the story, and that each chapter I tried to offer something, you know, that is an insight into either a person or a connection with another story or the way in which Megillat Rut fits into some of the broader themes of Tanakh. So I don't think you have to, you know, read all 500 pages in one sitting in order to read the book or learn the book, but you can really open it and you know, I mean, I certainly would hope that some people are reading it from beginning to end, but I know it's also very daunting because, you know, the most frequently asked question about the book is how could you write 500 pages on a 4-chapter book in Tanakh? So I appreciate that could be a little bit daunting, but I do think also the chapters, many of them do read as independent, not all of them, but many of them read as independent chapters, especially for people who are already familiar with the book and even with some of the rabbinic readings of the book.
Absolutely. Yeah, I really enjoyed the short chapters, like I said, split up. So, okay. So with that, thank you once again for joining me.
Okay, I'll take the opportunity, first of all, to thank you very much for this conversation and also to wish everybody a Chag Shavuot Sameach. And and there should be a lot of learning, not just of Megillat Rut, but also of Megillat Rut. Thank you. Thank you for having me.